like to call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3 p.m. on Tuesday, January 31st, 2023. Committee members with us today are Representative McCormick, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Sadler, Representative Sumner, Representative Fields, and Representative Lena, and myself, the Chair, Mike Prox. So I'd like to welcome everybody to the first meeting of the Health and Social Services Committee. And we're going to be doing a department overview, and this will be also the first meeting we hope to serve for the Finance Committee subcommittee meetings. And I'd like to also introduce Riley Nye, my committee aide for the Health and Social Services Committee, and House Records Recorder, Laurie Rowland, and I have a blank, I am sorry, for the teleconference moderator, and she introduced herself, Amanda, who is moderating the teleconference this afternoon. And I was saying, this afternoon we're going to hear an overview of the Department of Family and Community Services, and in the room with us are Kim Cavall, Acting Commissioner, Clinton Lasley, the Deputy Commissioner, Marion Sweet, Assistant Commissioner, and Matt Davison, Legislative Liaison. And I believe online we have Heidi Hamilton, the Director of the Pioneers Homes, Scott York, the Chief Operating Officer of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, Kim Guay, the Director of the Office of Children's Services, and Shannon Dilley, the Deputy Director of Juvenile Justice. And if you would, please hold your questions till the end of the overview, and then we will take questions and go from there. So, Commissioner, is it Koval? Koval. Please place yourself on the record and begin the overview.
So good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kim Koval. I'm the Acting Commissioner for the Department of Family and Community Services. I want to acknowledge today that I have Deputy Commissioner Clinton Lasley, Assistant Commissioner Marion Sweet, Matt Davidson, our legislative liaison with us, and also I want to acknowledge Chrissy Bugley, Special Assistant, who is in the room with me as well. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce both myself and the department to you in this new role. I have over 25 years of experience in the private sector in executive leadership, management, licensed facilities, organizational development and restructure, logistics, working in human and social services realm with youth and adults. Prior to this role, I served as Governor Dunleavy's special assistant with a portfolio focusing on domestic violence, sexual assault, missing and murdered Indigenous persons, human and sex trafficking, homelessness, foster child and elder care, opioids and fentanyl, and suicide prevention. I am deeply committed to helping Alaskan families navigate complex systems during some of the most challenging, difficult times in their lives. And I just want to say on a much lighter note, I do have hobbies outside of this. I am an avid Harley Davidson rider. You'll see me riding with my dog in tow along the New Seward Highway. You'll notice us because he'll have his dog goggles on, ears flapping in the wind, and that would be us. And for my fellow Star Wars nerd aficionados, I volunteer at community events with the 501st Legion, the Aurora Borealis Garrison, as the character Asajj Ventress. She is a Sith. And our motto is bad guys doing good. It's one of my passions. I love to volunteer and see the adults and kiddos react to Star Wars characters. I'm really proud that we have such an amazing and dedicated team, including the executive.
So good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kim Koval. I'm the Acting Commissioner for the Department of Family and Community Services. I want to acknowledge today that I have Deputy Commissioner Clinton Lasley, Assistant Commissioner Marion Sweet, Matt Davidson, our legislative liaison with us, and also I want to acknowledge Chrissy Bugley, Special Assistant, who is in the room with me as well. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce both myself and the department to you in this new role. I have over 25 years of experience in the private sector in executive leadership, management, licensed facilities, organizational development and restructure, logistics, working in human and social services realm with youth and adults. Prior to this role, I served as Governor Dunleavy's special assistant with a portfolio focusing on domestic violence, sexual assault, missing and murdered Indigenous persons, human and sex trafficking, homelessness, foster child and elder care, opioids and fentanyl, and suicide prevention. I am deeply committed to helping Alaskan families navigate complex systems during some of the most challenging, difficult times in their lives. And I just want to say on a much lighter note, I do have hobbies outside of this. I am an avid Harley-Davidson rider. You'll see me riding with my dog in tow along the New Seward Highway. You'll notice us because he'll have his dog goggles on, ears flapping in the wind, and that would be us. My fellow Star Wars nerd aficionados, I volunteer at community events with the 501st Legion, the Aurora Borealis Garrison, as the character Asajj Ventress. She is a Sith, and our motto is bad guys doing good. It's one of my passions. I love to volunteer and see the adults and kiddos react to Star Wars characters. I'm really proud that we have such an amazing and dedicated team, including the executive leadership and division directors with many years of experience in the services provided by our department. So the mission of the Department of Family and Community Services is to provide support, safety, and personal well-being.
Brief knees. Back on record, pardon the interruption, please proceed.
For the record, Kim Koval, Acting Commissioner, DFCS. Okay, so the mission of the Department of Family and Community Services is to provide support, safety, and personal well-being for vulnerable Alaskans. It's an excellent mission, yet after personally visiting our statewide offices, ranging from Udyabik to Ketchikan, and meeting with both rural and urban staff, I wanted to build on this. Our department leadership met to discuss what this mission means for each of our divisions. We came up with a department vision and guiding principles that support each division and reinforce our commitment to Alaskans. I'm happy to share them with you today. The fundamental value guiding the department is a vision of service first with these guiding principles. We will strengthen lives through meaningful connections with families, communities, tribes, and providers. We will provide safe, person-centered care with integrity and dignity to the Alaskans we serve. We will advance an agency culture that prioritizes the well-being of our workforce. We will mobilize innovative solutions to complex challenges. And throughout this presentation, you will see how our mission, vision, and guiding principles are being put into action. Now, on a fun note, you may have noticed that our principles spell out an acronym of a beloved Alaskan staple: strengthen, provide, advance, mobilize, SPAM, or as we call it, SPAM. So this is the organizational chart for the department. I'm proud of our stable and experienced leaders in all of our divisions. It is important to note that our directors and deputy directors are a consistent presence since the reorganization, including leadership in the commissioner's office. In other words, nobody left. In particular, the commissioner's office staff reflect key positions in later slides on how we meet our mission and vision with an emphasis on tribes and families. The Department of Health and Social Services reorganized into the Department of Health, or DOH, and the Department of Family and Community Services, or DFCS. Our department retained Alaska Psychiatric Institute, Division of Juvenile Justice, Alaska Pioneer Homes, and Office of Children's Services. These four divisions represent a unique feature: all our direct services and all are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. The majority of our staff work in the facilities or in the communities directly with our constituents and providers. Finance and Management Services and the Commissioner's Office round out our department. It is important to note that we work very closely with our sister department, the Department of Health. At times, you will hear us refer to our departments as two houses with a screen door between us that we consistently communicate and collaborate through. This continuing collaboration is centered on four key areas during the reorganization: complex care, improving the continuum of care, shared IT resources, and information technology debt. Complex care requires a continuous and strengthened partnership with the Department of Health. Both departments and several divisions are identifying and seeking solutions where the systemic gaps have presented themselves. We are currently working on building a coordinated system that flows between the Department of Health and Department of Family and Community Services with a focus on person-centered care. This system will encompass many touch points, which we will demonstrate later in the presentation. We are actively developing the information technology plan to ensure resources are applied to prioritize projects and minimizing delays. Finally, modernizing our legacy systems and utilizing contractors will ensure a higher quality of service for both internal and external constituents. A department whose focus is families and communities will encompass a plethora of priorities, and those can ebb and flow as each community and family is unique with differing needs. After months of one-on-one conversations and meetings with frontline staff, supervisors, executive leadership, community partners, residents, and clients, we identified four key priorities: complex care systems, tribal partnerships, the culture of our department, and workforce support. Over the years, the frequency of individuals, both youth and adults, requiring complex care and placement has been on the rise, with all four of our direct service divisions tasked with finding both appropriate levels of care and location of care. While this is not a new concern, it has magnified in complexity of acute needs, and it is time for action. We are creating a complex care coordination unit within the commissioner's office. This unit will establish a single point of contact for the department and our partners and will be central to coordinating complex care and placement activities within our service divisions. The unit will establish a network of existing placement options for both adults and youth while endeavoring to oversee long-term facility development within the state. Partnering with healthcare providers, medical centers, and clinics to expand services will take time. We'll be working with providers across the country, building relationships and documenting levels of service and care at locations to support the needs of Alaskans if we cannot find appropriate placements within the state. We will be working with all facilities in becoming Medicaid or third-party payer eligible to reduce the use of Alaska's general fund. I'm pleased to share that our first ever complex care systems coordinator, Michaela Varey, MSW, has hit the ground running with support from our Families Coordinator, former Representative Tammy Wilson. Through the Governor's Fiscal Year 24 budget, we will continue to build on the team by adding an additional Complex Care System Coordinator, a Social Services Associate, and a Deputy Director of Operations to oversee the unit. So care coordination is complex in that it requires assistance from both inside and outside the department. First, an assessment needs to be completed and an appropriate placement determined. Although that seems simple, that one individual might require many services like Medicaid, whether individual or facility, a licensed placement, medical personnel to manage medication, wraparound services, transportation, and most of all, family support. Each case is unique and it requires out-of-the-box thinking and collaboration with many agencies and organizations. The goal is to prevent anyone from being institutionalized, whether that is within corrections or a treatment center, and finding a family-like setting that meets their everyday needs. I want to emphasize how important that this is. On July 1st, 2022, when DFCS officially became its own department and I stepped into my role as acting commissioner, I was pulled into an urgent call concerning a complex care case with a single youth. And for the sake of this presentation, we're going to call him Jacob. There were nearly 15 people at that meeting, ranging from hospital executive leadership, nurses and their supervisors, doctors, case managers, social workers, Department of Family, the Community Services, and Department of Health directors from nearly all divisions. Clearly, everyone was trying to find a solution for Jacob with multiple phone calls to multiple staff, both internally and externally, in-state and out-of-state. There was no singular person acting as the project manager. And I asked offline, is this normal? And made the comment, we need to change the system immediately. There were subsequent daily meetings to find a solution for Jacob, and sometimes more partners were added at varying stages. It's important to point out that the diagram represents Jacob in his example of touch points ranging from public safety to medical services to the court systems or legal aid, educational support to basic needs like food, housing, transportation, and so forth. These touch points we are showing are ever-changing with additional resources added and some not required for individuals like Jacob. However, what you see is a very good representation of the numerous entities that our staff alone across four divisions connected with for one individual. For our department, it was logical for us to streamline the coordination through a single unit in the Department of Family and Community Services to eliminate redundancy and improve service efficiency. In addition to some of our division-level tribal liaisons, we are increasing our statewide connection and outreach by encouraging our designated tribal liaison, Ms. Mariah Cedar, Master of Science and Master of Public Health and doctoral candidate from my office to lead our tribal engagements. This means creating new relationships as well as reconnecting with long-standing partners. To date, we have connected with many tribal partners as well as attended events such as Alaska Federation of Natives Convention, the Bureau of Indian Affairs Providers Conference, and the National Indian Nations Conference to not only elevate the presence of the Department of Family and Community Services, but to illustrate our commitment as well. We are excited about the forthcoming opportunities and collaborations on the horizon and appreciate our tribal partners' enthusiasm and engagement with our office. Each of our divisions provide positive, life-changing services to Alaskans. I want to acknowledge that there are challenges when you work in a field of crisis response 24 hours a day. We work with families and individuals in need of support, resources, and solutions. Families and individuals' privacy and information are paramount and protected. Our families and staff are faced with difficult and emotional scenarios. Some will pull your heartstrings, some will make you cry, and others a high five because it was a wonderful success. These are important narratives, and one of my first initiatives of the new Department of Family and Community Services was connectivity and communication. Getting our stories there out to the public and providing information, education, and connectivity, we are developing a comprehensive communication plan. We've established a calendar to document and celebrate important department and community events and create a social media platform to showcase these positive services to the public. And in fact, we encourage folks to get out their smartphones and give us a like and follow us on Facebook to see some of these stories. We have increased our stakeholder involvement by building relationships with community partners across the state. I personally visited multiple sites statewide and asked our staff what was important to them. I spoke to residents and clients asking what we could do to optimize their time with us. Universally, I heard that recognition of the important work being done was critical, and ensuring that all Alaskans understood what the department services were would go a long way. Not only are we sharing knowledge with the public, we are changing the culture of the organization from within. Whether it's through tearing down barriers to efficiencies, or empowering staff through mentorships, or simply embracing positive change. We are shining a new light on our services, ensuring these stories are heard. Governor Dunleavy's People First Initiative provided for workforce stabilization initiatives for our Office of Children's Services staff. For the balance of the divisions, we are evaluating similar programs. To complement workforce stabilization initiatives, we are developing a department referral program. To address workforce challenges in our rural sites, we have offered alternate workweek agreements and flexible work schedules. We partner with the University of Alaska Anchorage School of Social Work with practicum placements in the Office of Children's Services, Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and the Commissioner's Office. Alaska Psychiatric Institute has a psychology internship, and the Child Welfare Academy trains all incoming caseworkers for the Office of Children's Services. We are in the application stage for SkillBridge to the Department of Defense, which provides service members up to 180 days to receive full-time training while retaining their service time. Service members will still be paid by the military while receiving real-world training experience. And next, I'm pleased to introduce to you our family, community, staff, facilities, and services. So first, we have Director Heidi Hamilton, who's been with the Alaska Pioneer Homes, or APH, for 23 years. The Alaska Pioneer Homes provides services including assistance with activities of daily living, nursing services, recreational and social programs, assistance with medications, dietary needs, housekeeping, and meal preparation. The homes provide a wide range of services for the most independent to those living with dementia-related diseases and advanced complex care needs. Director Hamilton has over 400 positions, a budget just over $104 million. And quite frankly, the cutest group of preschoolers enjoying story time inside the Ketchikan Pioneer Home. Across our six homes from July to December of 2022, we have maintained at least 80% occupancy rate, all the way to a 97% occupancy rate. Notably, our Anchorage home has maintained the lowest occupancy rate, and I'd like to provide some background as to why. The Anchorage Pioneer's home is holding 22 rooms vacant for remodeling and fire safety improvements. These mandated updates allow for greater safety and access for those experiencing limited mobility. What's more, thinking about complexity of care for elders, especially in Anchorage, they are more likely to have higher needs and less social supports. So for example, 90% of residents at Juno Pioneer's home have family living in Juno who are actively involved in their care, while Anchorage has approximately 50% of their residents who have local actively involved family members. Anecdotally, this can be explained by elders having fewer living home options in areas outside of Anchorage and Matsu, making the wait time longer in these areas, leaving more space typically available in the Anchorage home, which may or may not be their home location, surrounded by family and friends, should they decide to relocate. Alaska Pioneer Homes is proud to have opened the complex care neighborhood in Anchorage with a capacity of 9 beds. Resident Wi-Fi was installed in 4 homes, and there's something quite charming when you get to visit and see grandkids and grandparents FaceTiming and texting each other out in the residence. Our community providers coordinate with our facilities and staff on complex care needs and have worked to increase collaborations and opportunities to build and expand on those partnerships. And this is just one example I'm particularly proud of as the Acting Commissioner and as an Alaskan. A recurring challenge facing our homes is the increased number of elders on the wait list. For an elder applying to Alaska Pioneer Homes, there are 2 wait lists, inactive and active. When an elder applies to APH after reaching the age of 60, they can choose to be inactive, which means they don't need services immediately, but would like to establish an application date for future consideration on the wait list. Or they can choose to be active, which allows them to be considered immediately. From fiscal year 22 to date, the inactive list has increased by 187 elders, and the active list by 49 elders, demonstrating that year after year, there is a significant need for our services across the state. As noted from slide 13, we have historic and aging buildings ranging from Sitka at 110 years old to our Juno facility at 35 years old, with a deferred maintenance backlog and buildings not designed to meet the medical needs of our elder population currently. And we know this because more than 75% of our residents use a mobility aid. 50% require assistance with physical transfer equipment. Many rooms, doorways, and bathrooms are too small to accommodate not only the resident and the staff member, but any special equipment they may require. During my site visit to the Fairbanks home this past fall, staff were barely able to move assistance equipment through the doorframe or turn it into the hallway. And you can imagine the frustration this has on everyone involved and the additional wear and tear to the building. Anchorage Pioneer Home's fourth-floor complex care neighborhood, which requires a one-to-one ratio of caregiver to resident, opened in December of 2021 and has added 9 beds that can serve elders with high staffing needs to address behavior issues and secondary to dementia. Behavior issues secondary to dementia diagnosis. The average census is 7. Next, we have the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, or API, which is led by Mr. Scott York, who has been the hospital's chief executive officer and facility director since March of 2020. CEO York is an experienced and knowledgeable executive with 40 years in the behavioral health industry and corporate leadership. There are 5 inpatient units with 80 beds available to provide compassionate health care to support Alaskans in living their best possible life. APA is currently the only location in the state that provides competency restoration treatment for individuals who have been found by the court to be incompetent to stand trial. The fiscal year 2023 budget is just over $58 million. And I am pleased to share, as of this morning, we are at a census of 75, which is the highest census since 2019. API has begun developing a comprehensive plan to ensure that it is meeting the needs of Alaska in the continuum of care. Community and jail-based outpatient competency restoration programs are being developed in partnership with the Department of Corrections, as well as other initiatives to improve the operations of the hospital. The Chilcat Adolescent Unit was reopened in May of 2021. This unit has a maximum capacity of 10 beds and serves some of our most complex youth cases, providing the highest level of care in the state. Chilcat is consistently full, demonstrating high demand. It was identified that patients with neurocognitive disabilities have the highest incidence of patient-on-staff assaults. In March of 2022, the Denali unit was reopened for adults with neurocognitive disabilities. This specialized program created by our staff experienced a 55% decrease in patient-on-staff assaults calendar year 22 over calendar year 21. API is also a teaching hospital and is adjacent to the University of Alaska Anchorage. Medical and nursing students participate through clinical opportunities, and recently the doctoral psychology student internship program at API has been reinstated. This experience at API will provide ample opportunity to expand cultural competencies in Alaska. I'd like to invite Deputy Commissioner Clinton Lasley to the table to discuss designated evaluation and treatment facilities and the disproportionate share hospital programs.
And like for the record, Representative Stapp joined us at 3:15.
Good afternoon. For the record, Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Family and Community Services. So as you all are aware, whenever the Department of Health and Social Services reorganized this past year through Executive Order 121, most of the functions were picked in place. So we moved our 4 divisions over to the new Department of Family and Community Services. There were a few functions that moved over during the reorganization process from the Division of Behavioral Health to the new department. Those 4 functions are the Disproportionate Share Hospital Funding Agreements, or often referred to as DISH agreements, Designated Evaluation and Stabilization, as well as Designated Evaluation and Treatment. And those are often referred to as DES or DET. You'll often hear those acronyms. We also moved over Secure Patient Transport to the new Department of Family and Community Services. This work aligned with the work we were already doing prior to the reorganization. In FY 2020, we hired a new DES-DET coordinator, an individual to coordinate the stabilization and treatment services across the state of Alaska, and that was Ashley Christopherson. And I refer to her oftentimes as sort of an air traffic controller of individuals that are in crisis that need potential stabilization or treatment in a facility. And she tracks all of those individuals to ensure that they do not languish in DOC or in an emergency room, but they're receiving the level of care that they need at the time that they need it. The states receive an annual disproportionate share hospital federal allotment to cover the cost of DISH hospitals that serve significantly disproportionate number of under-resourced patients that is provided through that DSH funding. This funding also helps reimburse hospitals that meet the criterion for performing the DES, or Designated Evaluation Stabilization and Treatment Services, across the state. Designated evaluation treatment facilities provide both psychiatric evaluation and treatment, while designated evaluation and stabilization facilities provide short-term stabilization services only. Our state hospital designated facilities provide a critical service in the continuum of care. Our three partners that you'll see on the slide provide an additional 48 beds to the continuum of care. Some individuals requiring these services need secure transport to safely deliver them to a facility or stabilization and potential further treatment. Our staff are there to coordinate this transportation as needed through the secure patient transport. The budget for this new component that moved over from the Division of Behavioral Health is approximately $14.5 million.
Thank you. For the record, Kim Cole, Acting Commissioner for the Department of Family and Community Services. Okay, next we have Office of Children's Services. Director Kim Gui has been with the Office of Children's Services, or OCS, for 22 years, and the OCS director since 2021. Our child welfare agency is primarily responsible for ensuring the safety of Alaska's children, investigating reports of child abuse and neglect, and administering the foster care system. OCS is spread out across five regions with 21 offices statewide. The main offices are located in Anchorage, Wasilla, Bethel, Fairbanks, and Juneau, with smaller offices in hub towns, including, but not limited to, Kenai, St. Mary's, Gujovic, and Sitka. OCS has over 600 full-time positions with a budget of nearly $200 million. The Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact began in 2017, and the 32nd legislature passed HB 184, which codified it. I would like to take this moment to thank the legislature that passed an operating budget last year, which included an amendment to increase the budget for this compact. Along with the increased funding that Governor Dunleavy pledged, the budget for the compact went from $1.6 million to $5 million. Funding is spread across 18 co-signers, which represents 170 tribes. We are on the cusp of our 19th co-signer, which we hope to announce very soon. Negotiated funding puts an emphasis on prevention to address the disproportionate number of Alaska Native children who come into state custody. Co-signers can be creative and innovative in terms of how they utilize these prevention funds. For example, co-signers can utilize these funds to offer the positive Indian parenting classes, which includes culturally relevant components, child-rearing practices, strength-based cultural approaches to passing down parenting skills, traditional behavior management, and a support group, all while engaging in cultural and healing activities and crafts. Governor Dunleavy's People First Initiative included several items to help support the efforts of OCS. To better manage secondary trauma that our frontline staff experience, we have a mental health clinician to support employee well-being and provide critical incident debriefing. We have long-term, non-permanent protective service specialists who provide temporary coverage, much like a substitute teacher would. Building on support positions are 26 social service associates, office and administrative assistance to support programs such as the Compact, and centralizing efforts to increase family contact. The majority of these positions have been created and are undergoing recruitment. Retention incentives and the field training compensation program are in the final stages of approval with the Department of Administration. The Alaska Impact Alliance is a coalition of community partners, tribes, and the state focusing on child welfare and prevention work, which is facilitated by the Alliance. Governor Dunleavy's initiative provides support for older foster youth ages 18 to 21 to help give them a good start as they begin their adult lives. The funding increases vocational opportunities and financial assistance for housing, transportation, and other identified needs. The initiative bolsters support for foster care providers who take in kids with complex needs. After a rapid increase in the turnover rate for case caring staff from the end of 2019 through 2021, OCS is finally seeing the turnover rate decrease from 59.4% to 55.5%. OCS is beginning to experience more stability in the workforce as staff are retained, which leads to more consistency for families. While we celebrate this small victory in reducing our turnover rate, we recognize that we continue to have high vacancy rates for our case-carrying staff. HB 151 was enacted in 2018 and required certain caseload amounts depending on how long a caseworker had been with OCS. For new caseworkers, they should have a maximum of 6 cases until they have reached month 3 with OCS. For months 4 through 6, the caseload can increase to 12, and after 6 months, the maximum caseload should be 13. Due to vacancies from turnover, the statutory requirements are still difficult to achieve for caseworkers past their 6 months. Some regions still have higher caseloads than others, meaning that the more seasoned caseworkers have caseloads higher than 13. It is challenging for our smaller offices to balance caseloads. For example, if only 2 caseworkers work in that small office and one is new, the other has the majority of cases assigned to that office. OCS is consistently looking at and evaluating how to reduce the burden on frontline workers, including centralization of administrative functions and utilizing letters of agreements for alternate and flexible work schedules, as previously mentioned. And last but not least of our services is the Division of Juvenile Justice, or DJJ. Director Shannon Dilley just celebrated her 30th year with the state of Alaska, 25 of those of DJJ, and in 2022 took the helm of the agency.
Brief niece. Back on record, sorry for the technological difficulties.
For the record, Kim Koval, Acting Commissioner, DFCS. I'll just restart the slide. Last but not least for our services is the Division of Juvenile Justice, or DJJ. Director Shannon Dilley just celebrated her 30th year with the state of Alaska, 25 of those years with DJJ, and in 2020 took the helm of the agency. DJJ follows a restorative justice model that is reflected in its mission to hold juveniles accountable for their behavior, promote safety and restoration of victims and communities, and assist offenders and their families in developing skills to prevent crime. DJJ has 6 youth facilities: Johnson Youth Center in Juneau, McLaughlin Youth Center in Anchorage, Fairbanks Youth Facility, and Bethel Youth Facility offer both short-term detention and treatment, while Matsu Youth Facility in Palmer and the Kenai Peninsula Youth Facility in Kenai offer only short-term detention services. 13 probation offices are found statewide in all the larger cities, as well as smaller towns including Sitka, Dillingham, Kotzebue, and Upyabik. We have 426 full-time positions and a budget just over $60 million. Echoing the challenges of our other services, DJJ has been hit hard by staffing shortages. In 2022, critical staffing shortages forced DJJ to temporarily combine the detention and treatment units at Johnson Youth Center here in Juneau and the Fairbanks Youth Facility. 1 in 6 DJJ facility positions is vacant. I am proud of how DJJ staff have responded to these challenges. Our staff continue to prioritize and provide innovative, evidence-based services to youth and their families. DJJ has taken several steps to address staffing challenges, including a salary study for juvenile justice officers, or JJOs, that started in January of 2023. There are internal work groups focused on recruitment strategies, agency culture, and other improvement efforts. Program improvements include specialized treatment units for females, violent offenders, substance abuse, and neurobehavioral units. These programs are addressing the individualized needs of youth in our care. A significant DJJ success I want to talk about is the implementation of HB 105, which the legislature passed and then went into effect July 1st, 2021. HB 105 was an omnibus piece of legislation that updated the definitions of DJJ staff and facilities and brought Alaska into compliance with federal law related to minors who have been waived into the adult justice system. Previously, minors age 16 or older arrested for certain serious crimes were sent directly to adult jail. Adult facilities have difficulty managing these youth and often house them in segregation units to keep them apart from the general population. Since implementation, 15 minors facing adult criminal charges have been held in DJJ facilities pending the outcome of their criminal cases or upon reaching age 18. At this time, 2 waived minors are housed in DJJ facilities. We appreciate our partnerships with the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Corrections in this effort. And finally, I just want to bring it all together, talking about everything leading up to day 215, which is today. So I want to emphasize that I have come before you and to this department with a heart of service first. It became very apparent to me early on that I need to be present and connected with our staff, our partners, constituents, and visited many sites within the first 100 days. I was able to meet and talk to staff in all our facilities in Anchorage, Matsu, Juneau, Sitka, Ketchikan, Fairbanks, Bethel, and Utqiagvik. We had to reschedule Nome and Kotzebue for the near future, and then I promised Prince of Wales, Wrangell, and Petersburg I would be there soon. I have enjoyed meeting dedicated partners and exploring collaborations such as Restore Incorporated in Fairbanks, reestablishing our relationship with the Sitka tribe, meeting with new friends with the Arctic Slope Native Association, and celebrating increased treatment facilities with partners like True North Recovery. I'm very grateful to meet resilient employees who physically show up to our facilities and communities every day to help our youth, adults, elders, and their families address very stressful, difficult, and complex situations. It's been very humbling listening to individuals expressing both their accolades and criticisms, not to attack, but to earnestly contribute to solutions. Some of their solutions are a quick connection to a resource, while others may take more time and care to explore options with the families. And in the end, I ask, what is in the best interest of this child or adult or their family to help them on a path of health, recovery, and success? And I'm just going to do an audible. I spent an hour and a half last night at the Juneau Pioneer Homes, engaged with several residents, several dogs, a cat, a bird, and there was just some amazing, wonderful staff and folks to engage with and listen to their stories and also listen to some of their suggestions on improvements as well. I've enjoyed meeting our tribal partners. I've learned something new every day, and I'm honored for the new friendships being created there. And you know, truly, it's been an amazing 215 days. I'm looking forward to building on our guiding principles. I'm focused on our efforts on complex care, and I want to ensure we meet our mission to provide support, safety, and personal well-being for vulnerable Alaskans. Thank you.
Okay, there will be a 20-question multiple-choice test starting at 5. So, do we have any questions for Mrs. Coble? Ms. Coble. Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, and thanks to the chair, to you and all your department staff for their amazing public service and all these important divisions. And on the Pioneer Homes, I was just wondering if you could give us an update. As I recall, the department was analyzing whether it would make more sense to replace the Fairbanks Pioneer Home or to do a substantial renovation due to that facility being out of date. And I was just wondering what the status of that was.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Fields. If I may, I'd like to bring up Deputy Commissioner Lasley, as he's been dealing with this longer than I have. Thank you.
Thank you again for the record. Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Family and Community Services. Through the chair, Representative Fields, we did start doing the evaluation of what it would take to either do a complete new build or a partial expansion with a renovation. The contractor that we are utilizing for those engineering services are in the final stages of giving us a final report on that. Currently, we're looking at, with a new build and to make the rooms large enough to meet the needs, as the commissioner mentioned earlier, a new build is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million is what they're estimating. A renovation with an expansion that would meet the needs and not lose any potential bed space would be in the neighborhood of about $60 million. I think some of the challenges that we are faced with is a renovation would take 3 to 5 years because you would have to add space on, renovate, move elders multiple times. I think there are some challenges with that, and you know, the quality of life issues for elders having to go through a major renovation of that nature. As you know, some of the rooms in the Fairbanks Pioneer Home are, I think the smallest room is around 99 square feet. That's with a bathroom in between it, that and an adjoining room. And if you, I encourage you all to visit our homes because, you know, as the commissioner mentioned, many of our facilities are aging. And the population that we serve today is not the same population that they were designed for. So we always say that whenever these facilities were built, everyone walked through the front door. Today, that's not the case. And as the commissioner mentioned, 55% of our elders use some type of assistance in moving and transferring. And so, you know, currently we cannot even move an elder through into the first doorway, turn them 90 degrees to get them into the 99 square foot room. And then we also deal with, you know, the workers' comp issues and the challenges there. So we're working on it. The governor did approve for us to do this evaluation of what that would look like, and we should have the final results here in the coming months.
Could I ask one more related Pioneer Home question, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Fields.
Thanks, through the chair. Thanks for that update. Has the department analyzed the need in the Kenai, which is our largest area not served by the Pioneer Homes? I would like to devote to appropriate money to open a Pioneer Home on Kenai. I'm just curious if the department has analyzed the need in that community.
Through the chair, Representative Fields. At this time, we have not. I know that you brought that to our attention in the past. I think some of what we're looking at is, you know, taking care of the facilities that we currently have and making those upgrades. We're always looking for making sure that we have services in the state of Alaska that meets the needs of our elders and the community that they're in. So we'd be happy to look at that. We just haven't taken that opportunity yet.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sumner, I believe you had a question.
Yeah, through the chair to Commissioner Koble. So the turnover rate for OCS field workers, so you said it did come down, and I guess it came down 4%, but that still seems amazingly high. I mean, I'm sure that it's an extraordinarily stressful job and they see horrific things, but, do you think there's anything that could be done to get that turnover rate below 50% or?
Through the chair, Representative Hunter, thank you for the question. Short answer, yes. I do feel that we do have initiatives in place that are going to help move that number down. As I said in the presentation, it's a small victory. At least moved in the right direction. It wasn't an increase, it was a decrease. We have worked very hard on revising schedules, alternating them into week on, week off for some of our rural areas. We are seeing more applicants that are not degree carrying in social work or related fields like that they are, I want to say, I think we were at 30% of our case carrying frontline staff are not actual degreed social workers, which is growing. So we are seeing a different trend of who is applying. That's not to say that their work experience doesn't have value. It certainly does. We have hope that with the expansion with University of Alaska Anchorage and the partnership with the state and different partners of increasing the student base in regards to how many social worker students are going to be entering for their Bachelor of Social Work or the Master of Social Work, or BSW or an MSW. But that's years out in advance right now. So we do have our retention and recruitment plans in place. We are waiting on finalization from Department Administration. We feel that we're going to have that here fairly quickly, and we think that that's going to help us stem this off for the next few years. However, long-term wise, we will probably have to get a little more creative. It's a very stressful field. Every phone call is a crisis, and it takes a very special person with a very special heart to be able to filter that. With the governor's People First Initiative, we were able to put some positions in place to help with staff move through those very difficult situations and debriefing. So we feel that that will also be helpful as well.
Okay. Any other Representative Mina?
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, this is related to Representative Sumner's question. So I was looking at the OCS 5-year recruitment and retention plan today from last year, and it looks like that for this year, 2023, this is year 5, and at this point on the table it says that this year for year 5 we assess outcomes of prior year implementations and plan for the next five-year plan. And so I'm wondering what work is being done to prepare for that next five-year plan.
So through the chair, thank you, Representative Mina. I'm going to phone a friend and ask DC Lasley to come up, as this was developed before I was in this position. So I'd feel much more comfortable with DC Lasley addressing this one. Sorry.
Oh. I warned her about that.
We have a work order to fix that.
For the record, Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner. Through the chair, Representative Mina. So, the as you mentioned, the plan, we're in the fourth year of that plan. I think one of the challenges that we've had in state government as a whole, but in the Office of Children's Services, as the commissioner mentioned, this is very difficult work. But trying to really come up with some innovative solutions to entice individuals to come into the program, as the commissioner also mentioned, working with the University of Alaska to get more qualified candidates that can apply for these jobs. So I think what we're doing at this point right now is making some implementations, and then the next phase of this plan is to look at really trying to drive those numbers down over the next 5 years. I think as the governor put forward additional funding in the budget, which in the FY23 budget, which provided for recruitment and retention incentives for the Office of Children's Services, additional positions for support services so that individuals that are in supervisory roles can actually take leave and then have someone there to take on the casework whenever they're gone, additional mentorship program for the Office of Children's Services to bring on additional mentors for new hires. What we have been doing historically is we would provide mentorship for the first 6 months. We're looking to expand that so that they have additional mentorship for a longer period of time. And then also some behavioral health services, because as the commissioner mentioned, this is very difficult work and they work under some very stressful situations. So someone that they can go to and debrief with and make sure that they're taking care of their own mental health. So
thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair. I actually have like a whole sheet of questions, so hopefully, sorry. I'll try to be brief. This is obviously a new department, and there's a lot going on. I like that you put in here that a lot of the services you provide are very complex, but I've kind of heard over and over again that there, and not just in this hearing, but many others, that there's workforce shortages. Can you succinctly sort of describe, just for your overall department, what the workforce shortages and how they've impacted your individual departments, your department as a whole? What's sort of the state of your division with workforce shortages?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Ruffridge. Okay, so that's I'll try to cliff note this. In short, between the four divisions, one of the top priorities is that we need more nurses, PCNs, CNAs, anything in that category, any person of that professional nature is what we need to see more of. There is a definite shortage there. We are unfortunately put in the position of competing with private industry, and private industry can usually pay more, hire faster, and offer different incentives that we have to take longer time to negotiate through, and time is not our friend when we're looking at this. For DJJ, the Department of Juvenile Justice, the challenge there is our JJOs, our Juvenile Justice Officers. We are in the middle of a study right now, so we are hopeful to see that study come to us in the next few months. It just lifted off in this month, but time was working against us. So we need them now, and especially in Juneau and Fairbanks, and those areas have been hit very hard with the stresses of a reduced labor workforce there. For Alaska Pioneer, for Alaska Pioneer Homes is the same, would be nursing. So same with API and APH is the nursing challenges there. And then with OCS, it's with having social workers or the frontline case carrying workers.
And just to follow up, if I may, would you say that of the issues, and it seems like there's a lot to do with a new department, even though it's kind of shifting certain things, would you say that the number one issue facing the new department is workforce issues, or would there be something else that you would put in that spot?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Ruffridge. I would say that labor and workforce is a priority. It is definitely a top priority for the divisions in regards to just managing their day-to-day operations. I would say secondarily is legacy software is another concern for us in regards to, for example, our ORCA system with OCS. And I've likened it to telling folks we're dragging a typewriter and file boxes around, and that doesn't really look great when you're trying to hop a flight into the rural area when you could easily just be carrying a tablet and punching in the information and having it upload into a master mainframe and not have to carry all the stuff and then go back to the office and then re-enter the information again. If it's on paper, it needs to go away. It needs to be digitized, and we need to make it easier for our staff who are in the field so that they're not burdened down with administrative workload and can get the services and the needs of the youth or the adult handled quicker. I would say those are the top two. And then third, we have facilities, you know, the aging buildings and what we need to look at for deferred maintenance. And also the fact that those aging facilities, as DC Leslie pointed out, were designed in a different time frame with a very different health of population.
Last one. Just one more.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So I appreciate some of the topics that you brought forward, just with some of the I really like the successes and then the challenges. It's really helpful. I like to see both sides of that. You had mentioned in here competency restoration as far as the ability to stand trial. That's a very intriguing topic to me. Could you explain that just a little bit in greater detail, and then maybe answer the question of what happens to individuals if they aren't restored to competency? Where do they go, and what happens to them?
So through the chair, thank you, Representative Ruffridge. So I'm going to tag team with actually DC Leslie on this. I'm going to start, and I'm going to pass it over. So when you're looking at the makeup of API and our 80 licensed beds, 10 are for youth, 10 are for restoration, and then the balance are for adults, and then we have those subcategorized out depending on the need of the population. So do we have enough beds in the restoration licensed wing? No, we don't. Do we need more? Yes, we do. And what that could look like can be, we can be creative in regards to jail-based or community-based options. So now I'm going to punt it to DC Leslie.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. For the record, Clinton Lastly, Deputy Commissioner, through the chair, Representative Rivers. So currently, as the Commissioner mentioned, we have 10 what we call forensic beds for forensic restoration services within the hospital at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. It is currently the only restorative facility and services available to the state of Alaska. So individuals, if they are on a felony conviction, would be housed in the Department of Corrections. Sometimes if they have a misdemeanor, because they cannot get to restorative services in time, sometimes they are released, or maybe they're out of Department of Corrections and out on bond or bail. So currently we have up to 1 year to restore an individual to competency, or try to restore an individual to competency to stand trial. If they are not restored to stand trial, there are a couple of options. If the individual depending on the crime that the individual committed, they could be released because they can't be charged for that crime at the given time, and they're not competent to stand trial. If they are remain a danger to themselves or others, we could transfer them over to civil commitment, which means that they would transfer to our what's called a Title 47 civil commitment, where we go before the courts on a regular basis to determine their ability to be in the community. Otherwise, we are holding those individuals. But what we're working on doing today, as the commissioner mentioned earlier in the slide deck, we're looking at two initiatives to increase the number of forensic spaces or beds to serve individuals. Right now, we're actively working on an outpatient restoration services that would be for individuals that are out in community but have misdemeanor charges against them that have been deemed not competent to stand trial. And so we would provide those services in a community setting and work for treatment and restoration services. The secondary piece that we're working on is with the Department of Corrections is a jail-based restoration program, which would open up an additional, we're still in conversations with Department of Corrections, but potentially another 10 spaces for individuals to receive restorative services that would be held in the Anchorage DOC facility. And those individuals would remain housed in Department of Corrections.
Thank you. Representative Fields.
thanks. Like my friend from the Kenai, I had a whole page of questions, so I was trying to take them slow. But following up on that, so I know we've been trying to rebuild an 80-bed capacity for some time, and it's exciting to hear that you're close. What is an adequate number of beds? And I recognize you were just telling us that some of those beds are not at API per se, but maybe at DOC or maybe in the community. What goal should we be striving for in terms of total capacity just to provide public safety?
Through the chair. Thank you, Representative Fields. So that can be a very complex situation. Currently, we're licensed for 80. The reason why we are not exactly at 80 is because some of the rooms are built with the beds hard in. They're built hard in, which means there are two beds to the room, which we can't remove a bed. And for safety reasons, we choose not to fill some of those rooms with two patients. So just for safety purposes. Last week we topped at 74. Today we were at 75. So we are constantly making adjustments to see where we're at. There are a lot of opinions in regards to, we just need more beds. It's a lot more complex than that because those beds are all very different. Do we need 10 more restoration beds? Do we need 20, 30? Short answer could be, yes, we do. But once we fill those beds, does that mean I have another wait list of 10, 20 more right after that? Because then folks go, they have all the beds filled. We can file more Title 47s. That's a concern. Are those beds appropriate to be in a facility versus the community-based or the jail-based program? A lot of the trend is moving towards community-based and not looking at putting folks institutionally into another building is to look at how can we keep patients and residents in a facility or a home or something like that where it's more family structure, where it's smaller population, where they're getting more one-on-one care or better ratios. So the catch-22 is I could say, yes, we need double, we need triple, but we'll fill those in microseconds. And just because we create the beds does not mean we're going to have the staffing available for that as well, which is also the other challenge.
Mr. Chair, I do have more questions, but I can wait on others if other members have questions first. Okay. Thank you. Through the chair, I've been hearing from principals in my district recently that as schools have been unable to fill positions and classes are being taught by subs, and we have more than 30 kids per room in a lot of classes, and schools don't have counselors anymore. Violent kids increasingly are just being suspended because the schools no longer have the staff capacity to deal with them, sadly. And I just don't understand what the relationship is between school districts in your department. We now have these kids who are essentially being left out in the street who need to be somewhere? Is there normally some coordination with your department if these kids aren't already in services? Kids who are violent in the classroom and our schools no longer have the ability to deal with them.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, let me make sure I understand. You're asking if our divisions coordinate with different school districts or Department of Education in regards to specific youth that are out of school care?
Yes. So, correct, through the chair, I'm wondering, is it normal that, say, when a school district has to suspend or expel a kid who's been violent, is there normally any coordination with your department to say, hey, this clearly this kid needs support and is, frankly, also dangerous to their peers, and what kind of support can we give them and their family? And I just don't know if that coordination occurs.
Thank you. Through the chair. So, Representative Fields, I would say that unless the child is technically in our care, if this is a child that has already been identified through OCS and has already been engaged, then that caseworker would in theory be engaged because they would know that the child is out of school time or is in a different environmental situation. But our four divisions specifically are tasked with folks who are in our legal care. So, but it does raise an interesting question that we have been talking about in our department is when we are receiving phone calls from the public and from folks in different stages of crisis, and they are technically not in our care, to what extent are we, in many ways, acting like case managers, right? And so we've been grappling with this as of recent, and we're glad to see that people are calling us. That tells us that they're listening, they see that there's resources, that they're trusting to confide in us because they don't want to be in our care. But us simply just handing them a resource saying, well, here's a list of resources, that doesn't work. So there is a bit of case management happening, but we're just not sure how far it has to extend. So what you're giving an example of is kind of already happening. It's just not necessarily the same scenario.
Okay. Thank you. Through the chair, when the principals were raising this with me, it made me very concerned about these kids and the environment in the classroom, and I don't understand what support they have to try to get back on the right track. I did have another question related to workforce. Through the chair, I guess starting more than 5 years ago, the Alaska Primary Care Association stood up a pretty innovative work-based learning apprenticeship program for allied health professions. Last year, the congressional delegation funded expansion of that training program in partnership with AHA, the Hospital Association. And I was just curious if your department had looked at some of your openings to see, could you sort of build on that training program to help fill some of these frontline positions? And I just don't know if there's alignment or not, but I'm curious if you had looked at that.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Fields. I don't believe we looked at that particular program, but I have been in conversations with AHA, and also we are actively partnered with UAA. We're partnered with them for social workers and also social worker students, and also for the psych students. We have many of our staff that are going through certification through UAA for child welfare, and then we also have MSW or Master Social Work students that are in placement with OCS, API, and then we have a student ourselves in the commissioner's office. So we do have good engagement with the students. We've also, this is anecdotal, we've also heard that there's not enough students. And we, quite frankly, have very specific areas of focus, so it has to appeal to that student as well.
Thank you. Through the chair, I do have one more question, then I'll be done.
Okay.
And I'm happy to wait for others.
All right, very good. Go ahead.
Okay. Last year, I think we funded the Alaska Impact Alliance, and I remember some members had skepticism about it. It was kind of a new idea, so I was just hoping for a report on what did the Impact Alliance do over the last year, and should we keep funding it?
For the record, Clinton Lastly, Deputy Commissioner, through the chair, Representative Fields. So the Alaska Impact Alliance has been actively involved this last year, bringing together community partners and developing sort of long-term plans. I do know that they are planning to be, or members of their board are planning to be in Juneau here in a couple of weeks. But we can get you their most recent report that shows the work that they've done this last year and how they've been growing that program.
Thanks, through the chair. I just want to see if there's ROI. Thank you.
Representative Sabin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair to Commissioner Designee Koval, the first item in your vision says you will strengthen lives through meaningful connections with families, communities, providers, and tribes. I'm curious to find out what is the department's involvement with tribes, and are they on the same level? You know, families, communities, I can see, providers, tribes just seems to be a little bit of a, doesn't quite fit that group. Can you explain why that's part of your first point in your vision statement?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Sadler. So through the work with the compact, and DC Leslie can speak to this as he's been working on this for now several years, it's been vitally important for us to have those conversations with our tribes in regards to the compact and our child welfare. We also recognize that there's going to be bigger items for us to explore and not just focus on specifically child welfare, but also elder care. Where workforce and labor may have some opportunities and partnership. There's just so many different areas there, and there was not really one person out of the commissioner's office focused on this or one person out of the previous department focused on this for the purpose of child and family community services. So we brought in Mrs. Mariah Cedar. She has had extensive background in working with different diverse groups, through different boards and commissions, through her work in public health. And we've done some significant outreach with our different partners and looking at increased level of engagement. How can we do better partnerships? How can we look at child welfare differently? It's just started. We just brought her in. I want to say we've only had her for less than 3 months. And so far, we've been making some progress.
If I could, through the chair, just help me understand, is it because tribes are a quarter of who you work with? Or, again, I've seen them placed in the same plane as families and communities. So help me understand, again, how much of your work is with tribal authorities?
I'm going to ask DC Lasley to step in a little bit.
Yeah, for the record, Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner. Through the chair, Representative Sadler. You know, our tribal partners are critically important to the work that we do every day. And as the commissioner mentioned in her earlier presentation, you know, we do see a disproportionate number of tribal members in some of our services, primarily in the Office of Children's Services. But I think as we expand, as we build out this new department, it's critical to have them at the table as we're looking to expand services across the state of Alaska and making sure that we're caring for all of our citizens of the state. As sovereigns, we want to make sure that we're respecting their sovereignty in the state of Alaska. And we also want to make sure that we're providing culturally appropriate services whenever we are serving our tribal members. So they are a vital partner for us in the state of Alaska. And you saw the numbers that the commissioner provided for the Office of Children's Services. And whenever we see that large disproportionate number of children that are in OCS out-of-home placement that are our tribal citizens, we need to make sure that we're at the table working with them. And that's part of what we've been doing for the past 5 years at the Tribal Child Welfare Compact. And understanding that there are Indian Child Welfare Act laws that we also abide by across the state of Alaska. So I would not say that in every one of our divisions that they are the percentage of individuals we are serving are tribal citizens, but in some of ours they are a large portion. But regardless, they're an important part of our work, and they're an important partner for us.
I could follow up again. Thank you. I'm just going to put a real fine point in the question. What proportion of your work is done with tribal citizens as recipients and tribal providers as fellow providers of services? Please give some quantification. I understand they're important, but how many? How much?
And through the chair, Representative Sadler, we can provide that for each of our divisions. Well, the Office of Children's Services, I believe it's over 50%. 66% of our youth that are in out-of-home placement or come to them in contact with the Office of Children's Services are tribal citizens. And then on the other divisions, I would have to provide and get that data for you for the number of individuals that we serve on a daily basis.
And if I could, just to follow up on that, through the chair, in addition to the number of basically clients you're serving, the degree to which you're working with tribal authorities, health consortiums, whatever, to provide services, that'd be helpful to know too. Thanks.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, I have a question related to what Representative Fields was talking about in relation to apprenticeships and workforce issues. And so on the API slide, talking about API becoming a teaching hospital, I've heard a little bit of back and forth between frustrations with nursing students and having enough placements versus perhaps there being not enough students for these different placements. So I'm wondering, I'd like to learn more about that process of API becoming a teaching hospital. What's that timeline, and is there expansion potentially in the future?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Mina. So I would feel more comfortable if we were able to provide that to you in regards to a breakdown of how many students programmatically, what the application process looks like, and then success rate for hiring, et cetera. So we could get that to you.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Representative Ruffridge. Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. Did you have a follow-up? I'm sorry.
I did not.
Okay. Representative Ruffridge, and then Representative Field.
Thank you. Through the chair, going to the slide on designated evaluation and treatment, what is the process to become a designated evaluation and treatment facility? Is there plans to expand those into some other areas around the state? And how long has that service or that system been in place?
For the record, Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner. Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge. So the process of becoming a designated treatment facility is primarily they would submit an application to us in the Department of Family and Community Services. Before this was with the Department of Health and Social Services. And we go through the process of having a conversation with them to see what services they want to provide, whether they want to just provide the 24 or up to 72-hour stabilization, or if they want to provide the longer-term treatment services, which is with up to 30 days. So we're currently working with YKHC has actually reached out to us of interest of potentially becoming a designated evaluation and stabilization facility. They've submitted their application and have gone through the public notice process. So once in the coming weeks, we'll be having further conversations with them. So, and we're always looking for other facilities that want to come and be partners with the state of Alaska to provide additional stabilization or treatment services in the state of Alaska. The treatment services are required within a hospital setting currently, primarily. I would say it's a fairly easy process to get through. It's really providing that application and showing an interest that you want to provide that service. And then there's in statute, there's some very specific requirements as far as providing public notice and going through that. But and currently we, as I mentioned, we have the 48 beds, which is, you know, when we're thinking of API only being an 80 bed hospital with 70 of those providing designated evaluation and treatment services, having those additional 48 are critical. I would say another area that we're really looking at community partners for is, as the commissioner mentioned, we have 10 beds of those 80 that are dedicated to youth or children, 13 to 18, and that stays full all the time. So we are looking at expansion of potential other facilities wanting to become a designated evaluation and treatment facility for youth.
So is there an incentive for these facilities to partner other than just, I guess, is there funding or grant opportunities there? What's the process for that?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Ruffridge. So as I mentioned, that disproportionate share hospital funding is currently what is funding our designated evaluation and treatment facilities for those individuals that do not have any other payer source. And I would say, you know, the incentive is many of our communities and service providers want to make sure that they're serving individuals and their community as closest to home. And it also helps to keep those individuals just, again, languishing in an emergency room waiting for treatment. So the incentive is to really provide the service and care that the patient needs at the given time that they need it.
Thank you. Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, yeah, just following up on the apprenticeship issue that Representative Mina brought up. So in the last few years, our congressional delegation has secured ongoing apprenticeship funding administered through the Department of Labor, significantly more money than they had in the past. And I would just hope that as we now have a new commissioner, at least a new acting commissioner of the Department of Labor, maybe there's an opportunity to have a conversation around whether some of that money can be programmed to help meet some of your needs. I know a few years ago, the Department of Labor funded a CNA apprenticeship at the Pioneer Homes. And, you know, maybe there are other jobs where we can allocate some of that ongoing federal workforce funding to help meet other departments' needs. So it's just a suggestion. Thank you.
Other questions?
I had one. There was, forget exactly what it, if it was a lawsuit or a review, but there was a big examination of API and a report and an effort made to address all of that. Is that kind of behind us now, or is that ongoing?
Sure. Again, for the record, Clinton Lastly, Deputy Commissioner. Chairman Prex, that as you all are aware, back in 2018, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute was in crisis. It was struggling to keep its accreditation and remain open. Since then, we've made a lot of revisions at the division and had stable leadership in that division over the past few years. And I think it shows we've had CMS does come on occasion. We also are accredited by the Joint Commission. They have been there or done their evaluations, and we have remained in compliance. And I think that's really accredited to the leadership at the hospital. We've had stable leadership. We're able to provide the services, making sure that we're providing adequate treatment. And you know, I'm happy to say that I believe this year is the first year since I can recall that we've had almost all of our psychiatric positions and psychology positions filled in the hospital. But it's just it's the stabilization of the leadership from the CEO to the staff all the way down to frontline staff. It's just they've made a remarkable change over the past 4 years.
Okay, thank you. Then the other recently reported, I believe it was the Department of Justice, has done a review of Alaska's healthcare. Does the Division of Family and Community Services have any involvement in that, or is that for the other department?
Thank you, Chair Prox. So, yes, we do have involvement with our sister agency. However, our percentage of the involvement is actually not the same as Department of Health. There's a larger component to the behavioral health side of it. We are working with our sister department and also with the DOJ. We have not started recommendations yet, and so we're just in the early stages of that right now.
Okay. Thank you. Do we have anything else? With that, thank you for the presentation. This is still by itself a big department, complex problems to solve. We will have a lot of work ahead of us, which is good. That's why we're here. As far as this committee interfacing with the finance subcommittee, we're going to try and keep the finance subcommittee process moving forward as fast as we can, but also be thorough with that. And then I'm not sure whether there will be requests for legislation from the department. Commissioner Koval, there we go.
Third try, you got it, through the chair. We are looking at some pieces that do pertain to us, but we are not going to see a lot of fanfare coming from us. We are really trying to get our sea legs under us and make sure that we're focused on coalescing the divisions and focusing on our workforce and our clients and our staff.
Okay, good. And we'll try and take care of the legislation request as well, but in the first few weeks here, I think we'll be focusing primarily on the finance subcommittee work. And I'm guessing that Matt will be here. Will others be here? How do we interface with the department?
Chair Prox, kindly interface with Matt Davison, legislative liaison. That's great.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else for the committee closing comments? Good. Well, then the House Health and Services Committee is adjourned as of 4:25.